The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
This is Paul Zak, author of Immersion, The Science of the Extraordinary and the Source of Happiness. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Paul Zak to talk about his book, Immersion, The Science of the Extraordinary and the Source of Happiness, published by Lioncrest. Dr. Paul J. Zak is a professor of economics, psychology, and management at Claremont Graduate University and is one of the most cited scientists with over 200 published papers and more than 20,000 citations to his research. Paul's two decades of research have taken him from the Pentagon to Fortune 50 boardrooms, to the rainforests of Papua New Guinea. Along the way, he helped start several interdisciplinary fields, including neuroeconomics, neuromanagement, and neuromarketing. His other books include Trust Factor, The Science of Creating High-Performance Companies, and The Moral Molecule, How Trust Works. Paul is also a four-time tech entrepreneur. His current company, Immersion Neuroscience, is a software platform that allows anyone to measure what the brain loves in real time to improve outcomes in entertainment, education, and training, advertising, and live events. He frequently appears in the media in such places as Good Morning America, Dr. Phil, Fox and Friends, ABC Evening News, and his work has been reported in The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Time, The Economist, Scientific American, Fast Company, Forbes, and many other publications. And interesting fact, he met his wife on a flight from Cincinnati to LA. He served as a relationship expert on the Dr. Phil show and ABC's hit TV show The Bachelor, and he created a Valentine's Day experiment for NBC's Today show. Paul, congratulations on Immersion and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Doug. I will add this to my CV. It's very exciting to be here with you.
Well, thank you. And also, I read in your book that Fast Company magazine gave you the nickname Dr. Love.
Yeah, I did the original research, or my lab did, on this neurochemical oxytocin that we showed in the early 2000s is this key signal in the brain that someone around us appears to be trustworthy, we're likely to cooperate with them, increases empathy, and is the foundation for attachments to others, including people we love.
And we're going to talk about oxytocin, and not just because my dog is lying on the floor behind me, and I frequently hug him all the time. But it's my understanding that after that, the rock band Kiss wrote a song about you.
They call me Dr. Love. They call me Dr. Love. Call me Dr. Love.
And you were named by Wired Magazine as one of the 10 sexiest geeks. I'm so sorry. This is an audio-only podcast.
Yeah, that was about 20 years ago, so I don't think I'd make the list anymore.
Oh, well, I don't know. You are not an unattractive man. I wouldn't be surprised if you're also a Marketing Book podcast listener. Now, what you don't know is that when that list came out, 10 Sexiest Geeks, I was number 11. And they didn't put me on there. I was kind of a standby. So I want to thank a very special listener, Professor Tom Elmer at Westchester University, for recommending your book to me. He's a longtime listener. He has his students listen to the show, and he's become a friend over the years, and not just because he likes the show and sent me a bottle of scotch one year, and then a couple years later, he came to town with his beautiful wife and took me to dinner. Now, I'm not saying all listeners need to send me booze and take me to dinner, but, you know, just saying, if you want to, I'm not going to fight you on it. So I want to quote from a couple of places at the very beginning of the book. Page 11, you write, "For over two decades, I've been on a quest to understand human social behaviors. What makes us happy? Why do some teams work together more effectively than others? Why are some experiences transformative? These are a few of the questions I've investigated in my work as a behavioral neuroscientist. This research has taken me from the Pentagon to Fortune 50 boardrooms to the rainforests of Papua New Guinea in order to measure brain activity as people do what people do, all to understand and predict how people will behave and what causes these behaviors. While clandestine agencies of the U.S. government funded my early research, ultimately I discovered how to create extraordinary experiences." And then moving on, same page, says, "In the past 10 years, I've helped businesses, governments, and individuals create extraordinary experiences that bring happiness to customers, employees, and audiences. I've even helped couples find love on TV."
Oh, behave.
"The software platform my colleagues and I built from this research is currently being used by hundreds of organizations to radically improve marketing, sales, entertainment, customer experiences, and corporate training. Knowing what is highly valued by the brain enables businesses to avoid offering customers the bleak, monotonous, and uninteresting. More than avoiding the ordinary, extraordinary experiences create a craving to repeat the experience. As a result, businesses that consistently provide the extraordinary to their customers are extraordinarily profitable." And then jumping over to page 14, you write, "In Greek mythology, King Sisyphus was punished by the gods and forced to roll a boulder up a hill, only to have it roll back down for eternity. What Sisyphus was missing was a tool to keep the rock from rolling. Marketers, experienced designers, educators, and film executives are also missing a tool, something to ensure that the content they create is spectacular. More often than not, enormous effort is put into creating content that rolls to the bottom of the hill. Here's the good news. We now have the ability to solve this problem, and it is based on recently developed science." So tell us about the science.
Well, there's so much in there, Doug. Thank you. This all came out of work we did.
And I'll be back in about 45 minutes and see how you're doing, Paul.
This work came out of work we did early after 9/11, after the war of terror really ramped up, when we were tasked by the U.S. government to identify combinations of signals in the brain that would accurately and consistently predict what people would do after a message or an experience. So the goal here was to equip soldiers with a new superpower called persuasion. Could we create a test bed for soldiers to work out communication, whether that's verbal, written, audio, video, so that we might encourage both our allies and our enemies to cooperate with U.S. goals? So we used millions of dollars of taxpayer money. And as you know from the book, Doug, the brain is a very lazy organ. And most of the time, it wants to modulate that high energy cost by just idling.
You describe it as the brain is a lazy Republican, as I recall.
Yeah, which makes both lazy people and Republicans unhappy, but it's memorable. So yes, lazy because it wants to save energy. It's Republican because it's conserving systems that evolved eons ago that may be maladaptive today. In any case, in trying to figure out these combinations of signals in the brain that would accurately predict that people would do something we could observe after we gave them some information or an experience or information of some type, we sort of unmeaning to, if that's a word, not meaning to, we identified what seems to be the brain's evaluation network for social emotional experiences. So in short, if I tell you something and your brain goes, holy crap, that's the most interesting thing ever, this network is like your sweet little fill in your favorite ethnic stereotype. Jewish, Italian, Greek mother poking you in the head. Doug, do this thing, right? So that's what we discovered. And it turns out there's lots of applications to knowing what the brain values. And of course, that's highly variable across individuals. But the book has a lot of general rules we've discovered from measuring over 50,000 brains to figure out what motivates people to take actions.
Well, let's step back just a moment here for folks that are very busy, their heads are down, they're working hard, they don't quite realize the importance of experiences in business. And there have been a number of books on the show over the years about creating a better experience, and it makes all the sense in the world. But I still want to underscore that point. You write that the world is rapidly transforming into the experience economy. Once our basic needs are met, we increasingly crave extraordinary experiences. Why do people want those extraordinary experiences?
Yeah, we're rich enough to want that, most of us. Even if, you know, you go into the DMV or the Walmart, I still want to have a great experience, right? I don't want to have, I don't want to marry a boring woman. I don't want to have children that I find uninteresting. I don't want to walk into a store and have a boring experience. So what I do, and maybe what you do, Doug, is I will, when I interact with a salesperson, I'll sort of play with them a little bit and see if they'll play back with me.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do that all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. And I just want to see if they care about what they're doing. Do they want to make this a great experience? I was at a restaurant recently with a colleague, and they said, our special is this. I'm like, I heard that special's terrible. She goes, where'd you hear that? I said, I don't know, online somewhere? She goes, no, it's really good. And then she got the joke, and she goes, oh, yeah, it's terrible. You should definitely get it because it's the worst thing we have. Right. And now we had a fun conversation, and the rest of the lunch, every time she came over, we got to joke and have fun with each other, and she realized I was just playing with her. Now, half the time I do that, the person just looks at me and stares. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, why are you in a service job if you don't actually have an interest in humans? So the mantra that I say every day of my life is CLV, customer lifetime value. Mm. If I wow that customer every time or nearly every time, he or she not only is loyal, in the book, I talk about the neuroscience of this craving to repeat extraordinary experiences, but they become raving fans. They start talking about it to everybody else. What is better than that? So CLV is my mantra. It should be every business's mantra.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, in your book, you wrote about, the USA Today ad meter and Hollywood focus groups. And it was just hilarious to me because I've suffered in my ad career through all that goes into creating a big TV commercial, to have it evaluated in a false arena, like a focus group. And you write about how I think it was Ridley Scott and who the other director was, Manchurian Candidate director, just talked about how terrible that is. And one of my favorite parts of the book was on page 45, where, and I say it's my favorite because I've seen this movie, so to speak. I've suffered through this. And you write, even though the brain produces language, it cannot accurately reveal its unconscious emotional responses. Most people suffer from a Freudian hangover, thinking that if one digs enough, the unconscious will reveal itself. It just ain't so. Consciously querying the unconscious is like asking your liver to report how much it enjoyed the hamburger you ate for lunch. So can you talk about the problems that your research addresses, at least in my mind, and I think it may be what you neuroscientists call the signal extraction problem?
Yeah, the big problem is that people lie. And people lie not because they're malicious most of the time, it's because we're asking them the impossible. We show them a piece of content and we say, do you like this? Do you think it's going to be persuasive?
How much do you like it?
Yeah, yeah. Rate it from 1 to 7. I always say, compare to what? Compare to my kids? Well, my kids might be a 6 out of 7. My dog's a 7 out of 7, right? My dog's perfect. My kids, sometimes they talk back to me. So, but if I'm comparing an ad to my children or my dog, it makes no sense. So we're asking people to somehow evaluate their unconscious emotional responses. And it's just not the way the brain works. And so we have technologies now that let us eavesdrop on what the brain really values. And that's the question. Because I'm interested in customer lifetime value, I'm interested in predicting behavior, not on feelings. I have to ask, what areas of the brain could I capture that accurately predict market outcomes? And that's what we spent, 15 years of my life in the lab, never seeing the sunlight, pale as all get out, every day working hard to figure this out and then really share that. And honestly, the origin of the company, Doug, was that I never got out of the lab and people started showing up with suitcases full of money and saying, hey, we figured something we saw in the media said you can tell us what customers love, or how to make better marketing, or how to improve the training we offer. And I said, gosh, it looks like there's a market for this.
Right. And you write that immersion is only useful if it predicts market outcomes. This isn't about how much somebody says they liked a TV commercial in the Super Bowl by twisting a dial. So explain what immersion is and how you came up with that term.
Great. So I'm using immersion in a technical sense. That is, it's a data stream made up of two core components in the brain. So to be immersed, and I use that word again, and that's data for me. That's I have to use words to describe it, but this is a 1 second frequency set of signals coming out of your brain that we can capture with technology. So what does it mean to be immersed in something? The first thing you have to do is be present, right? If I'm consciously focused on something other than the experience you're creating for me, then I'm not going to be immersed in it because I'm spending bandwidth doing something else, looking at my phone or whatever. But the second is you have to get me to – can I use one bad word, Doug? Am I allowed?
Yes, because I'm going to ask you why later in the book you say the most important word in science is bullshit.
Yeah, I'm going to use a variant of that. So the two components of immersion is one, you've got to be present, and the second is – you have to give a shit about what's going on, right? And that was a term used by one of our early subscribers to our software that we built. I have to get you to care about it. And that caring is an emotional response. So emotions are how the brain tags experiences as important. So again, for listeners, if you think of the first time you saw your spouse across a crowded room, or the birth of your child, or 9/11, or anything that's highly emotional is tagged in the brain as important and saved in a very particular way that makes it more easily accessible. So this is part of the reason that extraordinary experiences create cravings, because they are literally top of mind.
Now, you mentioned earlier oxytocin, which is something that you mentioned throughout the book. Say more about what that is and then the role that it plays in immersion.
Right. So of the two components of immersion, attention and emotional resonance, attention is associated with the action of a neurotransmitter called dopamine binding to the prefrontal cortex, kind of turns on that conscious attention. And most of the second-by-second variation in immersion is due to another neurochemical, oxytocin, that drives what I call emotional resonance, the value that that experience emotionally creates in the viewer. And my lab was the first to show the behavioral effects of oxytocin in the early 2000s, as we discussed. And so we had hypotheses about oxytocin being part of this larger network for the valuation of social-emotional experiences. But if we think of marketing, let's just focus on that. How do I get you to care about it? First of all, I've got to get your attention, and that's just a gimme. But most ad agencies, marketers, stop there. I got clicks. I got eyeballs. I'm done. No, I've got to get you to care about this thing. I've got to break through all that background noise, as you said, that I've got to extract that important signal from all the background noise of your brain keeping you upright, breathing, and conscious to say, hey, this is important to you. And in the book, I go through a lot of detail on how to do that that we can talk about. But if it's not important, your brain's just going to flush it out. It's like, oh, this is not important. So if you think about meeting a wife, Doug, versus what you had for breakfast a week ago, Breakfast is not important. You just toss that out of your brain. You don't need to process that thing.
Yeah, but I certainly remember when I met my wife. So I can't leave the listener hanging. Is there any more that you want to say about why the most important word in science is bullshit?
Yeah, I think science is a systematic way to get rid of bullshit. And so, you know, whatever. You can guess. You can throw spaghetti at the wall. You can look at behavioral data, but that's ex post, right? That means I'm going to try something and hope, you know, sort of guess and verify approach, which is all right. But it's not very efficient. And Doug, I'm a super lazy guy, just like my lazy, lazy Republican brain. And, you know, I want to actually measure and have a high likelihood that whatever I'm doing is going to be effective. So at this point in life, and the book now is a year and a half old or whatever, we're able to predict outcomes, market outcomes with the high 90% accuracy using these immersion data. And so we've really kind of optimized a system to help people be more successful in the events they're creating.
Yes. And as I mentioned earlier, immersion is only useful if it predicts market outcomes, which is mentioned in your book a few times. Related to prediction, tell us about the study you did with BBDO, where immersion correctly identified commercials that produced the largest sales bump for 5 of the 6 brands you looked at. Okay, now this is, again, different from the USA Today ad meter, which is often quoted right after the Super Bowl, how much people liked it, but it really didn't have, often has very little to do with sales impact. Talk to us about this BBDO study you did. That was fascinating.
Thank you. Yeah. When we first started doing this commercially, you know, you do want to make sure if you're taking someone's money that it really works. And it worked really well in the lab. The government uses it. It was confirmed by third-party labs. But we continue to improve the algorithms and the methodologies. So we just internally, we had measured Super Bowl, immersion during the Super Bowl, again, using this case, fitness wearables. We can pull brain data, actually. The brain's connected to the rest of the body. We can pull it from fitness wearables or smartwatches. And we found a zero correlation between what people said they liked and what turned on their brains, if you will, immersion.
Uh-huh.
Great. And so we got data.
I hope all the creative directors heard that. I'm sorry. So, as a former ad guy, I'm allowed to say that.
And so, you know, we looked at, we don't have sales bumps for those 85 advertisers on the Super Bowl or whatever, but we do have YouTube views and YouTube comments. So we waited a month. We got the number of YouTube views and YouTube comments, and we found that there was a positive correlation between immersion and these two measures of buzz and a negative correlation between the ad meter liking measure and these measures of outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. Indirect measures, for sure, but measures. Anyway, subsequently, BBDO got in touch with me. The book tells all the details on that. And they said, hey, we're interested in this, but we're skeptical. Well, I like skeptical. That means you're using your brain. So they said, here's the game we want to play with you. We're going to send you 18 of our ads, which are for 6 different brands. So 3 ads for Bud Light, 3 ads for Guinness, 3 ads for Visa. And our clients have ranked those ads for sales bumps using whatever methodology each of those clients used. And we're going to hold that data. And we want you to predict blind which is the best ad for those 6 different companies.
And that excited you.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing better than a blind test, right? So there's no way for me to, I don't know, rig the analysis, throw out data, all kinds of games you can play with data. Not that I ever do that. I'm, you know, a very well published scientist. All my work replicates. But still, from BBDO's perspective, they're always concerned that, you know, maybe there's some rig in there. So I said, great, let's do that. So we had a modest number of people watch these ads, I think around 40. And then we generated a predictive statistical model. And this is back in, gosh, maybe 2016 or 2017. And even then, when the algorithms were not as good, for 5 of the 6 brands, blindly, we identified the best ad. And as discussed in the book, the pregnant, first of all, 83% is damn good for a blind prediction. Yeah. And like I said, we're much better than that now. And at the same time, you want to know, like, which of the brands could you not predict? And that was Bud Light. And later on, the BBDO guy said, actually, his name is Andy Wilson. I wonder if he could become a friend now. Uh-huh. Andy said to me, oh, by the way, Bud Light did concert promotions and swag giveaways at bars, and their sales were all driven by all kinds of things that have nothing to do with the ads they played on TV. So somewhere around, there is a video of Andy Wilson saying that we hit 100% accuracy, 5 out of 5. Well, they actually sent us 6 brands. So I'm going to stick with the 83% and be more conservative. But they threw us a red herring. And even that, the data didn't pick up on the red herring. The ads were not that good for Bud Light. And the sales shouldn't have reflected something else besides the only so-so ads BBDO had made for them.
The communications, right. Right. So, we touched on this earlier, but I had to laugh when you advise readers, you advise abandoning hope, all ye who pray to the false god of attention. So in other words, all those folks are saying, yeah, they were catchy, they were interesting, we got high awareness based on our ads. That's a false god, right?
I don't care. Where are the sales?
Where are the sales?
CLV. Yep. CLV is all I care about. Show me the sales.
Yeah. So one other thing from that one particular chapter, can you explain what you mean when you write that a narrative arc with authentic characters is really all it takes to be immersed?
So as we started doing this work, we looked at all kinds of communications. I mean, just zillions of them. And then afterwards, just so listeners know how we did this, we said, hey, we originally started with blood draws, as you know, Doug, from the book. So I did about 10,000 blood draws in the last 20 years. So we sucked a lot of blood out of people and used that to look at changes in neurochemicals. And then from that, we look at, tells us where to look for the electrical activity associated with those neurochemical changes. And so we just did a ton of work. And after these experiments, we would pay people because we were torturing them either by sticking needles in their arms or putting electrodes all over them. And then we would say, hey, you just watch an ad for, childhood cancer. You made $40. If you want to, do you want to donate some of your earnings to St. Jude Children's Hospital or some other associated charity? And we just compared brain activity for people who donated compared to people who did not. We did this over and over and over. So we really looked at those behaviors they were predicting. And again, these are cost behaviors. You earned that $40 that we paid you for jabbing your arm with a needle twice, right? So mm-hmm. It is, I think, a really good question to ask, why are some ads that are unlikable still effective, right? Or odd? That's a really good question. So as we looked at all these different ways to communicate information, again, a lot of public service announcements, but also like stuff from the government, notifications, all kinds of things. What we found was that the most effective way to sustain immersion and therefore influence behavior is to use a narrative arc, because that narrative arc introduces humans, puts them in a setting, often an unusual setting. And as social creatures, we are fascinated by what the other humans are doing. And our brains are so much more attuned to social information than any other animal, certainly any other mammal. And so we're just picking up those social cues all the time. So once I have these people in an unusual setting, then I have a crisis and I have emotional responses. And I see how they respond. Well, that's how we learn from others, right? We see what others do. This is why there's no shortage of movies and novels and all kinds of things for us to watch, because we're still fascinated by the other humans. So narrative arc is the most effective way to influence behavior, full stop.
So let's go to the chapter on entertainment. I gather you've done a lot of work with Hollywood. In fact, I think, didn't I read that you've actually done some of the you've actually been on the soundstage.
You left out my most important unusual fact. I'm a SAG member I'm an expert at doing background voicing, technical background voicing. So it's really fun to be on soundstages. But go ahead on the book. What's the question on entertainment?
Sure. So you pose this question, if humans have been entertaining each other for millennia, why don't creators of entertainment know good from bad while they're making it? And of course, you talk about some of these colossal failures that entertainment companies have had, the movies and so forth. How then can entertainment be improved by understanding what it actually does to the brain?
Right. I think, by having technology, it resolves an interesting philosophical dilemma, which is if I'm creating this piece of content, I love it. It's my baby. right? And I can't evaluate it objectively. It's not a question of whether the creator of that content loves it. It's a question of whether the audience will love it. Again, I just want to move sales, customer lifetime value. And so by having a technology that does not rely on the audience filling out cards with pencils or rating something on some kind of bogus scale.
What they're consciously stating.
Yeah, I'm getting into that unconscious emotional response, which is what I really want to provoke. So I'll tell you a very, very quick short story. I was doing a demo of our technology years ago at one of the major studios. And it was like a Friday afternoon and a bunch of, you know, their boss made them show up. A bunch of people didn't want to be there. Anyway, this one guy shows up and what I pulled was I was going to measure them live. Like I brought some wearables and said, hey, we're going to measure one of your current movies trailers now on you guys. And we're going to see how the data will let us diagnose how it could be made better. Right? No bullshit. Call my bluff. So anyway, we go there and one guy was just cranky. He just didn't want to be there. It's Friday afternoon. I get it. We finished collecting the data. And at the end, this cranky guy goes, by the way, I was a producer of this movie trailer. I've seen it 4 million times. It's not going to work for me. I said, great. You're wearing the blue wearable. Let's watch it. We'll pull your data up. So I pulled up his data, and we have these different categories for average immersion, high immersion, and then sort of super fans, people who are just over the moon neurologically. He was a super fan for his own content, but he was sick of it because he worked on it, but it was his baby. So that's a good example of how that self-report just doesn't correspond to what our brains do. So, you know, I just think measurement rules and, you know, intuition drools.
Measurement rules, intuition drools. I think I saw that in the book too. Yeah. So with a marketing podcast, I am required by marketing podcast law to ask a question somehow related to AI and machine learning. Okay. I don't make the rules, Paul. I just enforce them. Mm-hmm. So the one part that I found interesting about that was where you touch on how science is starting to invade the evaluation of movie scripts. And I don't know that that's a good thing. Talk about that.
Right. It's happening already. I mean, look at the strikes in Hollywood recently. And, you know, AI generated characters. So it's all going to happen. I think the difficulty here is that AI is really looking at averages, right? Feeding a lot of data in and looking at how in general does this work. What we have found by measuring immersion is that people like something that's reasonably familiar to them, but a little bit different. So we like new, but not too new. And you can train all kinds of AI algorithms to do that, but it doesn't do it very well. It doesn't do it as well as humans right now. And so by having this technology, it lets us measure how immersed people are in a script or a ad or a movie. Then we can actually be much better at content creation because, again, we're solving that philosophical dilemma. So AI, you know, is going to win eventually, right? We'll all be out of business, I guess. We'll just be pushing buttons, running machines. But for now, I'd really like to keep those humans, you know, very excited about these experiences we're creating for them. And, you know, the data in the book is 80% of Hollywood movies have lost money for the last 30 years. Which is heartbreaking because people, you know, I live outside LA. I know people in the industry and so much effort, so much time, so much money goes into the production of entertainment, but most of it fails to find an audience. So I think by having technology that says, what is the audience responding to? What should I extend? What should I cut? As opposed to, you know, cards at a screening, we can just get better.
Yeah. Moving on, you have a chapter on how immersion can improve education and training. Fascinating. And presentations. Tell us about how you, Paul Zak, prepared for your TED Talk.
We recruited a bunch of students, had them watch really good and really bad TED Talks, according to some website we found. Right. And we found that a 10% increase in immersion was associated with, I think, over 100,000 more online views. So, if you can use that narrative arc, if you can generate tension, have real emotions, and really be honest about it, right? You hear this a lot in entertainment, right? Yeah, actors and scripts have to be honest. But that's what AI doesn't do so well, right? We can generate an emotional script, have a crisis, have some tension, but the actors, the filming, the photography, all that has to convey the importance of the emotional response. And again, it's that emotions that generate that value in our brain.
Yes, and I learned about the TED Commandments. And anyone can Google that, the TED Commandments. And you write that they send these to you beforehand. And they include, thou shalt reveal thy curiosity and thy passion. Thou shalt be vulnerable. And thou shalt tell a story. I thought it was very interesting. I just thought it was interesting how you were able to sort of reverse engineer what worked well. And I guess it worked well for you.
It did. I think it's got about 2 million views, which is pretty nice. So one takeaway for the audience is, and we've found this in the data, is you've got to open hot. So the attentional response for immersion precedes the emotional response. So I've really got to break through that idling brain. So I'm a terrible person to go to the TED conference with, Doug, because I have seen so many talks. I just sit there and critique them. And so don't. As we say in journalism, don't bury the lead. Open with your best anecdote, the most important thing, the you know, hit me hard, hit me fast, and then backfill everything else. But you know, to do a talk that's chronological is almost always the worst style, right? So if you think of, you know, great books, great novels, maybe even a book called Immersion, it opens with a really hot scene, right? Something that's just like, holy crap, what's going on? And now I'm in, and now I can start to develop that story.
Yeah, like that one chapter where you were doing work with the military, and you start the story by saying, they asked you, is it okay if we beat you up a little bit?
Yeah, right. Yeah, which really happened. So, you know, then you go, okay, something interesting is happening here. So in the training space, again, I think publicly, Accenture has been using our software for 6 years. Accenture, a very interesting company. It's about $15 billion in revenue. They spend about $1 billion upskilling their employees annually. That's a huge investment. And the only measure of impact of that ROI was that post-event survey that we've all done. How was the keynote? Did you like the lunch? Was the hotel okay? Again, I don't care. I want to know, did that information get into and stick in your brain so when you go back to the office, you can create value for the organization? And there's a very high positive correlation between immersion and information recall weeks later. And so Accenture has actually changed their training. They found that their employees could not stay immersed in training, no matter how exciting the speaker was, even a guy named Doug Burdett, unless they could break that training into 20-minute segments. So they don't have anybody speak for more than 20 minutes, and then they switch and have people do, say, table work for 20 minutes, and then maybe 20 minutes of a debrief. And so they're breaking that hour into 20-minute segments and then switching gears so the brain can re-engage, if you will. They've also found that breaks need to be longer. Again, we can all sit on our butts for 4 hours and not move.
I often do.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that our brains work at that speed, right? So if I want to get stuff efficiently into your brain, I've got to think about what the brain's doing. And then again, that's a measurement issue.
Yes, yes. Well, the retailers in the audience will be interested to know there's an entire chapter on attractions and retail that amazes. I want to ask one question from that chapter. Explain what a narrative customer journey is.
Right. So this is not my discovery, but I stole it from somebody, I'm sure. But if
Paco Underhill.
Probably Paco.
Yeah.
That's a sweetheart. So if a narrative arc is the most effective way to sustain immersion and therefore influence my behavior, what do I do in retail? I want to create this story around retail. So in the book, I talk about, I suppress the name of the company, but a very large telephone company from more than 100 years old name who was cutting down salespeople in their stores, I guess, to save money, and had a big backlash, and used our software to identify how to create this narrative retail. How do I go through and tell a story about, it's mostly wireless now, there's almost no more landlines. So how do I tell a story about wireless, how great it is, and the broadband we offer, and the phone cases, and on and on and on. And they had some sort of ethnographers help them on that. It was a total fail because they didn't think about story structure. So once they were measuring immersion, they could create this storytelling event, and at the end of that storytelling journey, which customers could take by themselves, they didn't have to have a salesperson guide them through, you end up at a place where your highest profit margin items are laid out, right? So don't start with the highest one. Start with something that's going to intrigue you. Tell a story, and then get to a point where at these peak immersion moments is when someone wants to buy. So if they're going to buy, at a minimum, get the highest profit margin stuff out front for them to look at that first.
Yes, you're right. My team wanted to figure out what makes a great customer experience and how this drives sales. Zappos, famous for their extraordinary phone service, calls this making a PEC, or personal emotional connection. Could we capture PECs while people shopped, and could neurological immersion predict whether people purchased or not? We carried out a study at two luxury clothing stores to find out. It's very, very interesting. Back to Hollywood, but from that same chapter, you write on page 181 that customer experience designers should plan and rehearse and improve every aspect of the customer journey. Most designers focus on the physical experience, but I recommend augmenting this with the approach used by the director, Alfred Hitchcock. Tell us about Hitchcock's blue and green scripts.
Right. So Hitchcock would write two scripts, one which was the words and what was happening and the blocking and all the things you do. And the second script was the same setup, but what emotions the audience was meant to feel. And I think this is really great to guide the actors into the experience they're trying to create for the audience. So again, it's audience-centric, which is why I like that so much. And so by having those two scripts, I have the sort of functional part of this. So for, say, retailers, I have how I approach a customer, how I may reapproach a customer. But I'm advocating that we should also think about how I want that customer to feel. Mm-hmm. What experience do I want them to have when they come in the store? So I'm not sure this is in the book. I think it was in my previous book. I've worked a lot with a container store, and they have a very effective way to train their employees how to approach customers, how to develop a conversation with them, how to be of service to them. And so they would talk about the container store, about someone coming in saying, oh, I'm looking for hooks for my closet. Great. Hooks over here. But then ask them, what's the problem in your closet? Well, I'm running out of space. Okay, great. Now we have a conversation going. Well, there's a couple options. You can get hooks, no problem, but we also have complete closet makeovers. We have a person who can install it. So let me show you that as well. I'll show you the hooks, but let me show you this thing. So I'm upselling the customer, but at the same time, I'm giving that customer a chance to have a much more expansive or extraordinary experience, because now I'm thinking bigger. Oh yeah, my closet's too tiny anyway. What if I had this whole custom closet installation and had twice as much space as I had before? Gosh, that would be amazing, right? So again, there's no brainwashing here, of course, Doug, you know that. I'm just advocating that we think about it from the customer's perspective and not from, I want to make a damn sale so I get my commission, or whatever people think.
And that's when the salesperson has commission breath. Yeah, and that's solid gold advice there, because you know, the more that you are able to understand what problem the customer is trying to solve, you might be able to help them even more, and you might even be able to sell them more, rather than saying, what do you want to buy? Okay, here it is. And that reminds me of the perils of going to customers and saying, what do you want?
Right, and the Steve Jobs kind of quote that everyone knows, right?
Yeah.
I may not know what I want. I know I have a problem, and that's a different issue, and that's the way we should start. What problem are you facing that I might be able to help you solve? And then I'm a service person. Then I get also, as an employee, there's a chapter on employee experience. I get the satisfaction of like, hey, this person came in with a real hard problem. They first wanted a hook. They really needed is a bigger closet. And I gave them a great idea for a bigger closet, and they bought it, and they could not be happier. Mm-hmm. How good does that employee feel, right? You feel like, oh man, I just made this person's day.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So there is another chapter, change on changing people's preferences, which is, last time I checked, that's something very important to marketing and salespeople. Talk about the concept of psychological safety. Now, I've heard about psychological safety in the workplace, but talk about how what it is and how that plays a role in persuasion.
So when we looked at the factors that inhibit people from being immersed, some of those are poorly structured communication, say lack of a narrative arc. Another thing we found was that there is interference in the brain from the needed functions that keep us alive. So one of the folks I've worked with for a long time at Accenture, Bob Girard, I'll give his name out, wonderful guy, he coined this wonderful term or phrase, which is Maslow's hierarchy always wins. In other words, if your feet hurt, if your butt hurt, if you have to pee, if you're hungry, now you're burning bandwidth in your brain on those more urgent functions, and you have less bandwidth to be immersed in the experience I've created for you. Therefore, I need to monitor psychological safety. So I developed an algorithm that measures this, rather than using a survey, measures it physiologically. Right? At what point am I getting so much interference from the brain perspective for these basic needs that I just can't be immersed? So from a marketing perspective, it essentially allows me to throw away some of my sample because they were actually not able physiologically to have a great experience, and their data is not very meaningful. Right. And then also in the chapter, I talk about just making people comfortable. Anything you're doing, offer them a cup of coffee, a chair, a glass of water, whatever that is. It's so nice. I can remember, Doug, a short anecdote. I was with my daughter on a tour in Europe when she was in middle school, and we're in Delphi in Greece, which is way up in the mountains, snowy, where the Delphic oracles were. And it was cold, and we had an hour to kill before dinner. We're walking around, and I walk in this old shop. And this, no one in there, just empty. This is like, I don't know, March, and there's no tourist up there. And anyway, I started talking to the shop owner and offered me a glass of ouzo, this wonderful Greek. And then we're looking around, we're talking, and then we're picking stuff up. And, you know, of course, I end up walking out and buying something, but it was such a lovely experience. It was no pressure. It's just like he had nothing to do. We had nothing to do. We didn't want to be out in the cold street. We weren't dressed for it. And we just hung out with this guy for an hour, had some ouzo, and it couldn't have been nicer. So one thing we found also is that anything you add a social layer to will have higher immersion. So more people together is important. But also having that multi-sensory experience tends to raise immersion. So think of the smells, the sounds, the feel of something. All that accentuates the experience my brain's having and therefore raises immersion.
Let's talk about women, Paul.
Do we have another hour?
Yeah. We're not going to talk about what women want because neither of us have the answer to that. But you write on page 219, the same area, you say, women inspire psychological safety more effectively than men, giving them a persuasive advantage. How does that work? I don't disagree.
Right. I think women, we've got lots of data, physiologic data and survey data, that women just seem more approachable than men. Men are generally larger. They tend to be more aggressive. And so from a connection perspective, women have a distinct advantage. Again, there's a distribution, of course. But on average, I think that's a true case. And so from a persuasion perspective, if the precursor to persuasion is psychological safety and women put people at ease better than men do, then in general, there'll be better salespeople. And I put a little data on the book supporting that. And so I think, you know, we want to lean into, this is where diversity is so important, real diversity, kind of lean into what works. And so if I have 2/3 of my sales team are women because they're my highest performers, awesome. Let's keep doing that.
Yeah. You know, it's my sense that there are, I'm sure there's studies about this, there's fewer women in sales, but the ones that are in sales do really well for the most part. In fact, this from your book brought that to mind. You said a 2019 study reported that in sales, 86% of women met their sales quotas, while only 78% of men are able to. The analysis showed that high-performing women in sales emphasized connecting and collaborating, while men focused on achieving goals. Connection is the foundation of psychological safety, and we only connect to people who appear trustworthy. And then you go on to write that women also have an empathy advantage. So there you go. A lot of the sales folks out there can learn from that. Let me ask you about two other things from towards the end of the book. I'd like you to elaborate on the following from page 232, where you say the traditional view is that businesses exist to solve customers' problems. The modern approach is that businesses that want long-term success need to bring joy to customers. Joy is the foundation for the experience economy.
Oh, I like that sentence. Who wrote that?
Some very good-looking 6'4" guy, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So this is really delighting customers. So certainly customers come in with a need, and they want that need filled. I can fill that need on a commodity level. I can fill it so low cost, and I need to do a lot of volume to meet my revenue goals. I can add to that product some service, show you how to use this thing you're buying, or I can add, in addition, this amazing experience that wraps around the entire product, kind of joyfulness. And so that could be done online. It could be done by linking it to other users that you can form a user group with. As I mentioned in the book, all the major movie studios now have, quote, fandom departments where fans can talk about their favorite movies and TV shows and create fan fiction and go to Comic-Con and do those kinds of things. Why don't we do that for products? Right? If I'm an Apple guy, if I love my Apple Macintosh, why don't they invite me to be part of my local user group and maybe hang out with other weirdo Apple people who love Macintosh? Right. So there's so many ways to do this now to kind of add, again, that's a social layer, as I said, very important. But really think about delight. And actually, Apple does that. If you think of the unpackaging, the way Apple packs its products, just to take stuff out of a package is so joyful. And by the way, Microsoft just recently started doing that, to think a lot about packaging, which I think is interesting. And by the way, Microsoft, this is well known, they have about a 60-person storytelling division. They want you to think of stories for what used to be a commodity, right? Every PC came with Microsoft operating system except for Apple. But now they've realized that if I want to keep these customers long-term, I can't just lock them into using our software. I need to delight them. I need to wow them with how wonderful the entire ecosystem is.
How would you delineate the difference between joy and happiness?
Yeah, I think happiness is overused. I think joy is that kind of ecstatic moment where you have this wonderful delight that you don't expect. Where happiness is kind of a longer-term mood state where, you know, am I happy today? Sure. Had a good night's sleep. I got my dog. I got my family. But where's that bliss point? Where's that, oh my gosh, that was just an amazing experience. So I'll tell you a concrete example. I was at the DMV recently. I had to renew my license in person. I thought, I'm going to burn an hour of my life. It's going to be sitting around. It's awful. My DMV is fabulous now. Go state of California government. Checked in early, had my name, had my reservation number. I was in and out in 10 minutes. I didn't wait a second. They couldn't have been more pleasant. They chatted with me because I like to play with people. It was an amazing experience. And so I think even government agencies can do this, right? You can't renew your license other places, but at some point there will be options because we can outsource everything. Mm-hmm. So why isn't everything, why don't I go, hey, government wants to raise my taxes? Well, if I have great experiences at government offices, gosh, maybe I'd be for that.
Yeah, it's funny. I've had to go to the DMV probably two or three times in the last 10 years. It hasn't been bad at all. It hasn't been at all like the TV show Simpsons shows what the DMV is like. And sometimes dealing with my own city, it's just been it's surprising. I don't know. Obviously, we may have lower expectations. Yeah. Right. Well, now you mentioned a dog, and I just want to finish with this one last question because my dog is here. Fast asleep, like many listeners to the Marketing Book Podcast. Talk to us about how dogs And I gather you are a dog person. How might dogs train us to form more immersive relationships?
My German Shepherd Buddy, also sleeping here at my feet, like the loyal hound that he is. Yeah, so we've done research on animal-human relationships. Since I'm a social connection guy, you know, that's why are we letting these other species into our houses? Like, that's super weird. So yeah, we looked at what dogs do in terms of how interactions with us dogs produce a halo effect on how we interact with humans. And we found a very strong halo effect. So dogs are more effective than cats, not surprisingly, at inducing immersion and reducing stress. So now I'm getting higher psychological safety. So win-win. So the punchline, I think, for marketers and content creators and hotels is dogs good, right? So I understand some people have allergies to dander or whatever, but in general, you see that dog in the lobby, you see that dog sitting in the corner of the retail store. That's a great thing. One of the things I discovered, like probably you did too, Doug, during COVID times when all the gyms are shut down, I'm walking my dog five times a day. During COVID, people would walk across the street. I'm a big guy. Single women would cross the street, not to see me, but to pet that dog. So,
yes,
you know,
yes.
If the dog is an attractor to humans, and as a marketer, I want to attract humans to what I'm doing, dogs are a really effective way to do that. And by the way, that doesn't mean putting a puppy in your toilet paper commercial. That's irrelevant.
Oh,
it's live
right.
Dogs. So.
Yes, and you talked about how there are certain things. Was it I can't remember which one, but as I was reading your book, I was reminded of some print ad I saw for a car years ago. And it just showed the car with the golden retriever sitting there. And it was like, how is that helping you?
But you know how that came about, right? They had people look at the ad and go, hey, do you, sure, it's got a dog in it. Of course I like it. What kind of human being would say, no, I hate the ad with the dog?
Right. Or show me. There's a part in your book where you talk about the dogs and the babies.
Babies, right. Put baby in a commercial. Of course, I love it. Yeah. For listeners, if you look at commercials carefully, like unfortunately Doug and I do, you will see the random dog or baby in like, you know, TV commercials or YouTube commercials everywhere. Like, oh, people love this. Oh, it makes them feel good. Maybe. But if it doesn't have what I call product story congruence,
yes.
If that baby or dog does not feed into why this thing you're trying to sell is fabulous for a customer, it's just going to be irrelevant. It's not going to do anything more than maybe a teeny blip in immersion, but it's not going to affect sales.
Right. And in the book, another thing we have in common is we both like drinking Guinness. You wrote about that. Don't deny it. But you talked about a couple of Guinness ads. I guess it was from BBDO. And one of them was related to beer, and one had nothing to do with beer. There was no – the congruence wasn't there, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you just have a wonderful story and then drop in your logo or buy our stuff now at the end, it's not going to work. Even though the story will be immersive, it doesn't, the brain doesn't make the connection from the story to the product. So think how many Super Bowl ads you and I have both seen and listeners in which you really enjoy the commercial, you have no freaking idea what they're selling.
Right. Yeah, but I appreciate all the millions they spent entertaining me for 30 or 60 seconds.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. So, Paul, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
You've got to measure to be great. And if you think about how the brain values experiences, extraordinary experiences drive up customer lifetime value. So find a way somehow to figure out how to just bring that joy to the customer every time they interact with you.
Right. And if I could add something to that, it's like, don't be so fooled by what they say they like.
Absolutely.
Well, let's give the listener something to do. What is one thing the listener could do today to put in action an idea from your book to get them sort of thinking in the right direction?
Really thinking about every piece of content you create or evaluate. What's the story structure and how's that story structure relate to the call to action? So for example, we often see in commercials, the call to action at the end, and yet the immersion peak is in the middle because I'm using a narrative arc.
Mm-hmm.
Put their narrative peak or branding moment where that immersion peak occurs. So again, we have intuition. You don't necessarily have to measure like I do, but think about where that peak is and then have that branding moment or call to action at the emotional peak.
Mm-hmm. So looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
Gosh, you know, I've read just thousands of books.
Probably, yeah.
Life. I'm gonna pivot on that question and tell you that the first neuroscience course I ever took as an undergraduate changed my life because it was the first time that we were encouraged to be critical thinkers. We would read something, and then it was taught by two professors, amazing professors, and they would say, why does this make sense? Why is this right? Why could this be wrong? And I think that's a great way to go through life, is to have that critical thinking and first think, is this consistent with everything I know about the world? Is this consistent with the way things work? And then think about why it might be wrong.
Yeah. And you know, that brings to mind the story in your book and that we've talked about where BBDO said it was going to be a blind test and you seemed to get excited. Like, bring it on. Sure. Like, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and which is great. If I'm wrong, I've learned something, right?
Yes.
And I can get better. If I'm always right, then I've learned zero.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. So are there any recent or upcoming books you recommend or maybe you're looking forward to reading?
I've read a couple recently that are quite good. The Isaacson biography of Elon Musk is extraordinarily good. We all think we know him, and I held off buying it. It was really, really good. And secondly, a book probably no one's ever heard of, but was come out in the last couple of years, called Tuxedo Park, which is about an eccentric and brilliant millionaire in upstate New York who built a laboratory that did tons of important work. He was kind of an amateur, but not stupid. He was trained as a physicist that funded things like radar before the World War II government even ramped this up. He funded EEG that we use every day in medical settings, all kinds of things. He just built a science center in this city called Tuxedo Park that Albert Einstein went to. Anyway, Tuxedo Park, really worth a read.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I just brought it up. Tuxedo Park, A Wall Street Tycoon, and the Secret Palace of Science That Changed the Course of World War II. Wow, you had me at World War II, one of my favorite topics. Let me just click add to list there. All right. Well, that sounds very interesting. Well, at Marketing Book Podcast, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including the books that have been mentioned, your company's website, Immersion Neuroscience, your LinkedIn profile, your Wikipedia link. A word to you, dear listener, please, please reach out to Paul and congratulate him on the book and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. If nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn so others can find it and tag us so we can thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is Immersion, The Science of Extraordinary and the Source of Happiness. The author is Paul Zak. Paul, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
I had a ball. Thanks so much.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.